Welcome to the Yoga Meets Movement Science podcast. I'm Jenny Rawlings, a longtime yoga teacher and educator, and I'm joined by my co-host, Dr. Travis Pollan, an exercise science professor and a longtime yogi himself. Together, we take a science-based look at many of the common questions, myths, and controversies that arise in the realms of yoga, movement, and fitness. Join us on this crash course where the worlds of yoga and movement science collide.
Welcome to episode 47 of the Yoga Meets Movement Science podcast. On this podcast, we're going to talk all about cardio and conditioning. So we'll start off with a just introduction about what the cardiovascular system is and how we train it, why it's important for our health and for our longevity. And then we'll talk about what sorts of activities can be considered cardio and what sorts of things can't. So we'll dive into some myths around cardio. In particular, we'll talk about whether yoga can be considered cardio. We'll also talk about whether cardiovascular training interferes with strength adaptations, whether cardio is good for recovery, and then for yoga practitioners in particular, what types of cardio should yogis be doing? How often should they be doing it? How intense should it be? What should they do first? Should they do cardio? Should they do strength training? Should they do yoga in a given session? And then last, but certainly not least, how can yogis find motivation to incorporate cardio into their overall movement practice? To dive deep into those topics, we have a very special guest. His name is Alec Blennis. Alec is a hybrid athlete, strength and conditioning coach, and self-described science nerd. He has a Bachelor of Science in Physics from Georgia Tech. As a coach, he's worked with a wide range of clientele from endurance athletes to powerlifters, first responders, weekend warriors, and everyone in between. He is also a former professional obstacle course racer and ultra runner, having completed over 50 ultras. He is also the current world record holder in MRF, which is a CrossFit workout that we'll talk more about in a couple minutes. He is a coach for Complete Human Performance, and he is also the creator of the Sex and Zombies program, which combines physique training to get you to look good with the tactical fitness you need to survive the impending zombie apocalypse. So without further ado, Alec, thank you for coming on the show today.
Hey, Travis. Hey, Jenny. Thank you so much for having me on. Really looking forward to talking about cardio and how to implement that and combine it with yoga.
Yay. We are so happy to have you on. And Travis and I have followed your work, Alec, online for a while now. And we just really appreciate so many of the takes that you share and kind of like unique perspectives, but that are super science-based, and you're always providing your evidence for them, but just a lot of like eye-opening and informative information and perspectives that you share. So we really appreciate that. And also, I'm so happy that I learned from you that you're actually quite yoga familiar. And as you told us before we started recording, your wife has done yoga teacher training and you did a ton of yoga with her during that time. So you're, even though we're talking to you as, you know, like an athlete, you also have a lot of yoga familiarity. So I know our audience will appreciate that. But speaking of your athletic endeavors, Travis mentioned in the intro that you are the world record holder of the MRF, which is this CrossFit workout. I've heard of the MRF, but I'm sure that a lot of our audience will not have heard of that. So could you tell us just a little bit, like what is that? It's so impressive that you hold that record.
Absolutely. So MRF is a special workout. It's a Memorial Day workout, kind of celebrated throughout the CrossFit community and even the military community a little bit. So it's a workout that has a lot of special significance honoring Lieutenant Michael J. Murphy. But it also, you know, has a lot of notoriety because so many people do it every year and they have done it every year for a long time. So to, you know, perform that workout and put down the best time that anyone ever has was a big accomplishment for me. The workout itself is all while wearing a 20-pound weight vest, a 1 mile run, 100 pull-ups, 200 push-ups, 300 squats, followed by another 1 mile run. And that workout was really right up my wheelhouse, and it was special to me because my niche in the, you know, kind of athletic space is combining strength and cardio and trying to be very good at both of those things. And to me, of all the workouts out there that has some notoriety, that was a workout that I thought really combined strength and cardio really, really well. You know, you have to be able to run some fast miles. You have to have the cardiovascular endurance and muscular endurance to get through all those reps. But you also have to be, you know, strong to do them with a weight vest, keep moving quickly. So I set that world record in 2021. I've held the world record for the last 2 years. And it's been a lot of fun, you know, talking to people about it, helping people train for it, all that sort of thing.
And the record is like low 30 minutes, right?
Yeah. So there's a couple ways people will go about the workout. You know, the spirit of the workout is when the time comes around every Memorial Day, just get it done however you can, whether it's with a weight vest, without, break up the reps, not break up the reps, et cetera. But the official record format is with the weight vest on. And then not breaking the reps up. So all 100 pull-ups before moving on to the push-ups, before moving on to the squats. And my record is around 32 minutes.
That's crazy and so impressive. I watched the video, actually. You have it on your website. You link to it.
Yeah.
And it was very cool to see. It's like that it's filmed and there are commentators. And yeah, that's very awesome.
And I guess a little more of the cool backstory is like you didn't train extremely specifically for that. It was more just like you'd been doing those movements for many years athletically, right? So whereas maybe other people, if they were setting out to break that record, they would have a very specific training program geared towards those three movements plus the running, you know, but you kind of just were like decided you were going to do it and then did it and then
yeah,
that was it.
I kind of broke it accidentally just at my own gym, you know, on Memorial Day, realized that I could break the record and then set up a formal attempt, you know, with the video and the commentators and stuff a few weeks after that.
Amazing.
That's awesome. Well, another thing about your background that Travis mentioned in the intro was that you have your bachelor's degree in physics. And I know that Travis does as well. And so we were kind of... Yeah. We were kind of wondering how that might inform your approach to training in general.
Yeah, for sure. You know, and a lot of the best fitness coaches I know didn't go to school for exercise science or kind of start off that way. And I think it's important that we have in the fitness space people from a wide variety of backgrounds that look at things in different ways and take different approaches. But for me, coming from, you know, a hard science like physics, a very fundamental science like physics, I think gave me a unique way at looking, you know, just at like the research side of it. You know, I remember going, doing research lab in my physics program and trying to, you know, replicate some of the most famous experiments, like, the Rutherford kind of gold foil, experiment, and like doing those in class and realizing how hard it was, to do really, really good science. And I think that's something we take for granted, you know, especially in the fitness space, a lot of the like research that's done and stuff like that. I don't think people realize just how hard it is to do really good science and then, you know, make that applicable to the real world and that kind of thing. So I think having that kind of perspective on it is really, really helpful. But then also, you know, just understanding your, you know, levers and momentum and conservation of energy and that kind of stuff is super relevant to exercise as well. So I think it benefits me in a lot of ways.
Yeah. I like to think that it just like helped inform the way that I think about and approach problem solving, because it's such a, like a systematic approach where, you know, you have your knowns and then you have your unknowns and you try to solve. And that's like universally true of problem solving. So even though like I went on to pursue a degree in biomechanics and then rehab science. So still incorporate physics to some extent, but not like E&M and, you know, quantum mechanics that I was doing in undergrad. But it's like those general problem solving skills, I feel like apply so broadly. And I feel like that comes through in your very systematic approach.
I think another big part of it too, is like when you're going to school for something like physics, you're very aware that, you know, to solve a lot of problems, you have to make a lot of assumptions, you know, it's like you sit down, you read like the textbook and you got a homework assignment. And it's like, you know, assume that a penguin is a cylinder and you're like, okay, I can do that. Like that's a wonky assumption, right? But, you know, it makes you very aware of like to be able to solve the problems and come to the conclusions that you do. There's a lot of things that you have to assume along the way that are not, entirely correct. And that's certainly the case in biomechanics, right? But I think that a lot of people, you know, online and in the fitness space today, they come up with this sort of solution or biomechanical model of why X exercise is best or why to use this handle versus that handle. And there's so many assumptions made along the way that I think people lose sight of. But I think going to school for something like physics, you're very, very aware of all those assumptions about, you know, friction and heat and uniformity and all that kind of stuff is something that's very much in front of you. And I think that's really important to keep in mind with biomechanics too.
For sure.
That sounds like a really good tip to keep in mind. And I could see how maybe not being conscious of the assumptions that we're making can definitely, like when you're aware of them, maybe that's one thing, but when you're, you know, learning things or just maybe repeating things that you've learned out there in the biomechanics realm without necessarily a conscious awareness of the assumptions that are built in, I guess I could see how that could lead one astray, maybe lead to some claims out there that deserve some questioning, like the things that we see that you post. But anyway, to try to gear our conversation a little more toward the topic of focus today, which is cardio and conditioning and all of that good stuff, could you maybe give us kind of like a simplified, brief-ish description of what is the cardiovascular system, just so we have this like base level, you know, we're all on the same page about what we're talking about?
Yeah, for sure. So when people talk about, you know, cardio, I guess like the shortest kind of description of it, people could be talking about the cardiovascular system, cardiopulmonary, cardiorespiratory, you know, there's all the different kind of combinations there, depending on which part we're really, you know, talking about. But when I think of cardio, I like to think about just the entire aerobic energy system. So when I think of the aerobic energy system, that's really everything that takes, you know, oxygen from the air that we breathe, the fuel that's stored in our body, and turns that into energy for us to do some sort of movement or exercise or whatever. And that's really a series of kind of interdependent processes from, you know, taking oxygen in, you know, breathing in with your lungs, that oxygen getting transported to the blood, getting pushed out through your vascular network, you know, your veins and arteries, whatnot, making it all the way to, you know, your working muscle tissues, et cetera. And then lastly, kind of being used by the cells or more specifically the mitochondria in your cells. And, you know, to do that, you need the oxygen and you need fuel from your body, whether stored fat or stored sugar. So cardio to me is really anything and everything that is part of that process of taking the air, turning into energy and kind of everything that goes on from start to finish. A lot of people think of just kind of the heart itself, you know, the very cardiopulmonary aspect of it. But, you know, everything from, you know, the blood itself to like your veins, arteries and capillaries, to the cellular level with the mitochondria. That's all super important as far as cardio goes.
That makes a lot of sense. Thank you for explaining that. So it sounds like there's like a macro level that we might think of just like inhaling and exhaling air, but then it really goes all the way down to this micro level of within the cells themselves and how they're uptaking and using oxygen. And it sounds like it's a complex system that we're talking about.
It is. I think that, you know, when people focus on the heart rate itself, and we'll get into, you know, some of the like myths and misconceptions around cardio, but a lot of people oversimplify it and they're like, well, just get your heart rate up or just sweat. And like, you know, it doesn't really matter. You know, the details around your cardio doesn't matter. But, you know, with everything else, we're very specific about, you know, what kind of positions are we getting into or what is the weight on the bar or the number of reps we're doing? And like all the details matter. And cardio is no different. I don't think we should oversimplify it down to just heart rate alone or any of that stuff. I think it's good to be aware of some of those details behind the adaptation.
That was definitely an eye-opening experience for me as I was learning from you recently, like just about, so I've been doing more CrossFit lately and like, I swim too, but like better understanding the difference between like a more cyclical task and the cardio adaptations that you can get versus doing like the more metabolic conditioning that is CrossFit. Like, yeah, your heart rate, you know, is up, but it's not exactly the same. And like for some people, for me, that's fine, right? Yeah. But if you like, but to be accurate, you can't just say, well, lift weights faster and then it's the same, you know, you're getting the same benefit, right? Because it's different. So if you want to make sure that you're getting the adaptation that you're after, then you have, like you said, you have to actually be specific and not just like blindly assume that based on heart rate, you're good to go.
Yeah. Yeah. And I hate to be the, you know, you don't want to be the guy that's like, well, technically, you know, I'm like, get into like, you know, making it not fun or whatever. And it depends on where you're at in your overall like cardiovascular, you know, journey or career, however you want to call it. You know, the more beginner you are, the less a lot of these details are going to matter. But you know, the more advanced you get, the more kind of nuanced or specific you get with some of your goals, the more you're going to want to know about it too.
Mm-hmm.
That makes a lot of sense. So you've mentioned that heart rate is something that like a lot of people are kind of aware of as something that we want to pay attention to or tune into when we're thinking about cardio. Are there other measures of like cardiovascular intensity and exercise? Like for example, like VO2 max or percent of VO2 max, things like that. Or is heart rate just kind of the main one we should rely on?
Yeah, for sure. So, I mean, heart rate definitely got super popular with, you know, endurance sports, right? So if you are a triathlete or a runner, cyclist, that kind of thing, you know, heart rate can be a really good tool for measuring your intensity, kind of measuring the training response and adaptation, that kind of thing. But, you know, for better or worse, a lot of those sort of ideas around heart rate training have trickled down into other forms of training. And people think that, you know, there's a specific heart rate zone they need to meet and that kind of thing, which doesn't necessarily hold true for every form of training out there and for every person. So I think heart rate training has great potential. It's a great way to measure intensity in some contexts, but it might not be the best way to measure intensity for everyone. There's a number of other things that you can look at as far as kind of the systemic or global impact of cardio. So what is it doing for your heart itself? Percentage of VO2 max is a great one. Unfortunately, most people don't have a good, you know, access to a lab or anything to kind of see where their exercise falls on that. But at the end of the day, if you're picking a, you know, what I would consider a good cardio modality, so you're doing something cyclical as in running, biking, swimming, some sort of constant movement, traditional cardio modality, just using either heart rate or a percentage of like a race pace or time trial pace, a power output, you know, it's like measuring it in watts, or even just measuring effort on a scale of 1 to 10. I think, you know, classifying your effort as easy, medium, or hard, that's for, you know, what most people are trying to do with their cardio. If people just, you know, classify things as zone 1, 2, or 3, you know, 1 being easy, 2 medium, and 3 hard, I think there's a ton of potential just for a very simplified scale like that.
That's really helpful because I think there can maybe be a tendency to overcomplicate it or maybe that's necessary and helpful when we get to certain stages. But I think also particularly our audience, like on the Yoga Meets Movement Science podcast, is probably not a ton of super high, like elite athletes. So maybe people for whom this information would be more relevant at that simplified level. So that's helpful to know. Yeah, I had wondered just like personally in some of my like reading up on cardiovascular exercise, like there's heart rate and then there's the oxygen uptake, which or percent of VO2 max, which I believe is connected to like energy expenditure. And for example, mm-hmm. how many calories you're burning, that's. And I know, like you said, we can't, everyday people can't really measure their percent of VO2 max, like outside of a lab, but that's really the measure that kind of counts when we're talking about energy expenditure. Is that true?
Yeah, so for like cyclical modalities, you know, if you're running, biking, swimming, there's a pretty well-established relationship between your heart rate and your percentage of VO2 max. So you can, you know, plug it into a formula or whatever, and you can say, okay, my heart rate is at 80% of my max. That means my, you know, percent oxygen utilization is probably at X percent of my VO2 max. And it's a relatively linear and predictable relationship. But there's a couple of things that can kind of disrupt that, you know, certain stressors, extreme heat, a variety of things can make heart rate not be as good of a measure. It's what we call a proxy measure. So it's kind of predictive of that underlying energy expenditure, but it's not always perfect. But truth be told, for things like running, biking, you know, those cyclical modalities, it's pretty good. But in a lot of other cases, it's actually really not good at all. So when we get into something like, you know, a CrossFit Metcon, or even more extreme, take someone who's in the middle of a panic attack, for example, like their heart rate could be through the roof. They could be sitting, you know, just sitting here talking like I am to you with a heart rate of 150 beats a minute. that doesn't mean their energy expenditure or their oxygen utilization is actually significantly elevated. So sometimes there's a big disconnect between what your heart rate is doing and the actual underlying metabolic stress. Again, if you're doing a kind of classic cardio modality in relatively controlled conditions, that heart rate's a great way to estimate or predict that metabolic demand. But in a lot of other situations, you know, especially if there's a lot of muscular tension involved, a lot of psychological stress, stimulant use, dehydration, heat, there's so many factors that can kind of cause that relationship to break down a little bit. And generally, it's in the direction of skewing heart rate higher than what the underlying metabolic demand is. So a lot of people are pursuing some of these like mixed modal conditioning workouts, doing like kettlebell circuits, or they look at their heart rate during a yoga class. That's you know, not exactly a cyclical modality. They'll see that heart rate much higher than what the actual metabolic demand is, and they might have a false sense of how much cardiovascular stimulus they're actually getting from that activity.
Hey, quick question for you. Are you someone who wants to be fit, healthy, and happy? And what if I told you you could get your dream body by simply just listening to a podcast? I'm Josh.
And I'm KG, and we are the hosts of the Fit, Healthy, and Happy podcast.
Listen, we get it. Fitness isn't easy. Carbs, no carbs.
Just stop, okay? It doesn't have to be that complicated. And that's why we made this podcast. We get straight to the facts so you can become your best you.
So the way to check us out is click the link in the show notes or search Fit, Healthy, and Happy podcast on any of the major podcast platforms. We'll see you soon.
Thank you so much for outlining that. That was definitely, especially the yoga example that you gave, was one that we wanted to ask about. There specifically, and I guess yoga in general, but specifically a question about hot yoga. So like yoga done in the heat, and maybe you've done some of that or are familiar with some of that, but there are a lot of like, there are widespread claims in the yoga world that if you take hot yoga, that it, and I, maybe they talk about it cardiovascularly, but it's often in terms of calories burned. It's often like hot yoga burns more calories. And we've wondered about that. And there is, and maybe you've seen this before, there is a study that was done back in 2017. Travis and I talked about it on the podcast like quite a while ago. But the title of the study was Objective and Subjective Measures of Exercise Intensity During Thermoneutral and Hot Yoga. And thermoneutral being just like room temperature. And they took a group of people and they did like one yoga class in normal room temperature. And then on a different day, the same people did the same yoga sequence, but in a hot room. And then they measured heart rate. They measured RPE, rate of perceived exertion. And then they measured oxygen or a percent of VO2 max. And what they found was that in the hot yoga group, or the people on the hot yoga days, they had higher heart rate and higher subjective feelings of exertion. Like they felt like they worked harder, but their actual oxygen consumption levels were the same as in the room temperature. And so we thought that was really interesting. What do you think about that?
Yeah, for sure. And this is a big topic with like endurance training too, with like adapting to the heat and that kind of thing. All else being equal, and that's like a huge caveat that we'll get into, but all else being equal, if you do the exact same workload in a hot environment, there's going to be a little bit of additional metabolic demand for cooling yourself. But we know that all things are not equal. And generally being in a hot environment, you're not going to be able to work quite as hard. So if you take someone and tell them to go run a mile as fast as they can out in the heat, they're not going to be able to run as fast as the person that gets to run that mile in cooler weather. If they had run the exact same pace, you know, I run a 6 minute mile on a 40 degree day versus a 6 minute mile on a 90 degree day, that 90 degree day mile is going to be more metabolically demanding. But that's probably not what's actually going to happen. You know, when I go out on that 90 degree day, I'm not going to be able to hold that kind of pace. My effort is actually probably going to go, or my actual output is probably going to go down a little bit. So I think that's where people get a little bit confused with heat training and kind of heat exposure is, you know, they know that all else being equal, there's an additional demand to the heat, but they don't take into account the fact that that heat affects what you're actually capable of doing and it's going to affect your performance negatively as well. Given sufficient time to adapt and get used to the heat, humans are remarkably adaptable when it comes to hot climates and given, you know, repeated exposure over several weeks of months. Several weeks or months, your performance will get, you know, pretty close to what you could normally do. You know, the first time you exercise in a hot environment, it's absolutely terrible. Give it a couple weeks, allow yourself that time to adapt. Your performance will steadily increase, but you're never going to be able to quite match your, you know, cool weather performance in a hot environment. With the yoga example, you know, if you truly made the sequences completely identical, put the exact same amount of, you know, effort into holding each pose and that kind of thing, I would expect that hot class to have a little bit more metabolic demand. But having done hot yoga and, you know, you start slipping a little bit and all these sorts of things, I strongly suspect that your actual ability to perform and work your muscles and whatnot is probably not going to be up there with the cool environment.
That makes so much sense. Thank you for elaborating on that for us. And yeah, I think it's just it's a good maybe eye-opener for many people as far as it makes a lot of sense. And I think it's so helpful to understand now that heart rate is maybe a good indicator of your actual, I don't know, the like cardiovascular input or work that you're doing when you're doing cyclical types of training, like we've mentioned a few times, like running, cycling, swimming, I think would be the same. So those are just very like same movements over and over. That's cyclical. But then when you start to get into other types of movement activities where it's not so cyclical, those two aren't necessarily as correlated.
Yeah. And some people might be interested in kind of, you know, why is that? How can the heart beat faster? And it's not actually, you know, what's going on for the heart rate to beat faster, but not actually be doing more underlying work. So I think it's important to understand that, you know, that oxygen utilization or percent VO2 max that we've talked about, that's really related to your cardiac output. So the actual volume of blood being pushed out by the heart. And that's kind of twofold. You know, your heart is going to fill up a certain amount with blood. It's going to empty partially. The heart doesn't actually empty 100%. There's a small amount of blood that kind of stays in there all the time. And then you have how fast your heart is beating. So you basically have that stroke volume, you know, how much blood goes out of the heart with each beat. And then you have your heart rate, you know, how many beats per minute. Multiply those two things together and you get your total cardiac output. To understand that stroke volume piece, you have to know the kind of filling capacity of the heart. And you also have to know what's called the ejection fraction. So how much, what percentage of that blood is getting pumped out on every beat. So that's dependent on blood actually coming back into the heart. You need blood flowing into the heart for it to fill in the first place. And then that's dependent on the heart really squeezing or twisting forcefully to get a lot of blood out. A couple of things happen in a variety of environments, like a CrossFit metcon or yoga class, hot environment, all these sorts of things that can affect some of those variables. A big one is whenever there's a lot of muscular strain or muscular contraction, when you kind of squeeze your muscles, that actually kind of restricts a lot of the blood vessels in your body and prevents blood from returning to the heart as much as it usually would. So when you kind of cut off the blood supply for blood coming back to the heart, it's not going to be able to fill up as much. So essentially you have, you know, your big powerful heart, it's only filling up, you know, halfway or a quarter of the way or whatever, because you've kind of restricted that input. It compensates for that. It wants to maintain cardiac output. It's trying desperately to keep pumping blood out to the body, but it's not getting enough in to fill up all the way. So it compensates for that by beating really quickly. But because it's not actually filling up, it beats faster and faster and faster. That doesn't necessarily mean that more blood is exiting, because there's less kind of blood going in the first place. So that's really important in kind of a high intensity environment, like strength training. You know, you can do a set of 20 back squats, for example, or 20 deadlifts. Your heart rate's going to go through the roof because those are such high tension activities. They really cut off a lot of blood from returning to the heart. In heat stress, you can see a little bit of similar things. In an acute episode of like tachycardia or a panic attack, you actually see the same thing. The heart kind of tenses up and it doesn't relax all the way. It stays partially contracted. So it has to beat faster and faster and faster to keep getting enough blood out, because it's also not actually relaxing and filling up all the way. So that's one of the primary reasons where in a lot of these kind of non-traditional environments, you see that heart rate go so high, even though there's not actually a lot of blood flow occurring.
And then the guys say, well, what do you do for cardio? Anything more than 6 reps. And it's like, yeah, your heart rate is really high on a 20 rep set of squats or deadlifts, right? But it's not the same.
Exactly. Yeah. And when you look at traditional kind of cyclical cardiovascular modalities, compared to resting, you might see overall cardiac output. So like total blood flowing through the heart, it could be, you know, 4 to 7 fold kind of higher than resting. So, you know, like the significant, you know, 400 to 700% increase, or even in very, very strenuous strength training, you might see a 50 to 100% increase in cardiac output, which is not nothing, but compared to what you can see with endurance training, it's actually a relatively small increase, even when heart rate does get pretty darn high.
That's a good way to, you know, juxtapose those with numbers.
Absolutely. And it's just so great you talked about that, because we also put out to our listeners if they wanted to send us like any questions for you today. And someone asked actually that exact question. What did she say? I have recently noticed since I've started wearing a smartwatch that my heart rate often gets higher during strength training sessions than it does during my walks. And I think that kind of maybe confused her. It made her think like, oh, well, am I getting my cardio input from my strength training? But you, like, just as you explained.
Yeah. And I think it's important to recognize too that, you know, whether something is cardio or not, it's not really a black and white sort of question. You know, you have a lot of things that are in between. You know, if you are doing a CrossFit Metcon, for example, there's going to be a little bit more metabolic demand to something like that than just, you know, straight lifting and that kind of thing. So understanding where does the stimulus fall on this continuum from, you know, true, you know, strength to true cardio, everything in between, and what do you really need and how much of that do you need to, you know, achieve optimum health or pursue your you know, fitness goals, whatever those may be. And I think recognizing that there is some middle ground, especially if you're someone who's not trying to be, you know, an elite endurance athlete. If you just want to be, healthy, you know, have healthy blood pressure, manage your weight, whatever it is you're using cardio for, there's definitely a space for some of those kind of in-between modalities. I don't think they're inherently bad, but it is helpful to just kind of realize that they are not the cardio that you might have thought they were.
That is so helpful. And I know a few times we've mentioned the term Metcon, but I think some people in our audience might not know what that is. Would you mind defining Metcon? And also I'll just throw out there, how is it different or similar from HIIT or HIIT, high intensity interval training?
Yeah. In Metcon, it's funny, it stands for metabolic conditioning, which in a sense doesn't mean much of anything, because really any sort of exercise you do is some form of metabolic conditioning. You know, you're training some sort of energy system, right? But, you know, how people usually use the word is in the context of like combining a bunch of different exercises into one, you know, whether it's a circuit or just a couple of weeks for time, doing 5 rounds of, you know, 3 or 4 things. You know, it could be squats, it could be kettlebell swings, you could throw a short run or bike sprint in there, really any combination of, you know, kind of strength, cardio, whatever, put those into a circuit, do it for time or do it for rounds. See it a lot in CrossFit, but you see it in, you know, other workout programs too. You could sort of, I guess it has a lot in common with high intensity interval training, you could put it into an interval format. So I guess it really depends on the kind of, it's kind of semantics, I guess. What the difference between the two is.
I guess from my perspective, like high intensity interval training might have more dedicated rest periods than like a typical Metcon that might just be continuous, but sometimes a Metcon would have rest programmed in too. But like a high intensity interval training might be like 30 seconds on, 30 seconds off, or 45, 15, where there's just a little bit more. Like there's typically rest in there.
Yeah.
Whereas a Metcon may or may not, but kind of similar concept of like you're working hard and then you are maybe resting or maybe not resting. And the modalities could be some of the same, right?
Yeah. You can definitely see some very high heart rates in a Metcon, especially when you do combine, if you combine something like high tension, you know, like a heavy squat or like classic CrossFit example of barbell thruster is like a super common movement in Metcon. You do an exercise like that where you're restricting blood flow returning to the heart. The heart has to beat faster to still try to maintain cardiac output. And then, you know, you run a 400 meter dash after that. You know, you have those kind of two things side by side and you're going to see some extremely high heart rates. You might even feel like you're going to pass out. You know, you might have some like blood pressure, you know, ups and downs and that kind of thing. So they can feel extremely, extremely demanding and make you feel absolutely awful. But sometimes people, they then look at that data and they're like, oh my God, my heart rate was like 200. And they think that that was the same thing as just doing like a structured, you know, 4x800 meter run or something like that. And they think they can use those interchangeably. where despite, you know, still seeing some of those super high heart rates, despite still feeling like you're going to puke, the stimulus is different. There's still a value in it, especially if you want to be good at those sorts of things. But it is different, and it's important to recognize that.
I really appreciate the way you kind of outlined this spectrum or continuum from like purely cyclical cardio to something like strength training, which is more like high intensity for short bursts. And like, but there is a continuum, and you were mentioning that like somewhere in the middle, some of these things we've been talking about, like Metcons and HIIT training, maybe kind of fall somewhere in the middle. And if you're someone for whom your goals, like I think many in our audience would relate to like having goals of more just general fitness rather than like elite athleticism. It's nice that you mentioned that they could still be a value for maybe that type of population. So along those lines, we kind of wanted to ask you about, and we've touched on it a bit, but just yoga in general as a practice, which we know that you know is quite varied in nature. Like there are many different styles of yoga, but like just kind of based on what you know of yoga, I guess I'll just ask, like, could it be considered cardio, or could some forms of yoga maybe fall on that middle ground for some people? Yeah. What do you think?
Just a quick moment to interject and to thank you for listening to this episode of the Yoga Meets Movement Science podcast. As you can probably tell from this conversation, Travis and I value taking an evidence-based approach to the body and movement. We channel our understanding of movement science into our one-of-a-kind Strength for Yoga remote group training offering, which is a monthly strength program we created to make strength training accessible and relevant for yogis. Our Strength for Yoga program also comes with unlimited access to my full yoga class library. Use code PODCAST30 for 30% off your first month in our program, or your first month in any other membership on my website. You can learn more and sign up at jennyrawlings.com, and the link is in the show notes. Also remember that other ways you can support us are by signing up for my email newsletter at jennyrawlings.com/newsletter, and by subscribing to this podcast and leaving us a rating or a review. And now back to our episode.
Like just kind of based on what you know of yoga, I guess I'll just ask, like, could it be considered cardio, or could some forms of yoga maybe fall on that middle ground for some people? Yeah, what do you think?
Yeah, for sure. So when it comes to any sort of, you know, kind of in between, kind of mixed stimulus, you know, like whether it's a yoga class, a Metcon, a kettlebell circuit, something that's not pure strength or not pure cardio, the benefit to that really depends on the fitness level of the individual. So if you're already a pretty good aerobic athlete, you know, if you run, if you bike, you swim, yoga probably doesn't have a lot to offer you in terms of additional cardiovascular stimulus. Still a great thing to do, which is, as far as, you know, the aerobic system is concerned, you're probably not going to get a whole lot more benefit from it. On the other hand, if you're, you know, a brand new beginner, if you've never done any sort of cardiovascular training before, there's definitely still going to be some cardiovascular adaptation on the table for someone like you. You know, a couple of things you can look at just to kind of see, am I improving? Am I getting better? Is like your resting heart rate. Your resting heart rate is a pretty decent measure of your overall aerobic fitness. So if you start a yoga practice, for example, you might notice that over the course of a couple months, your resting heart rate drops a little bit. And then you'll probably notice that it kind of plateaus and doesn't drop much lower than that. Generally, we see, you know, people with really well-developed cardiovascular systems, people in the lowest kind of percentile rank in terms of like disease risk and mortality, they often have a resting heart rate in like the 45 to 50 range. It's not a perfect measure. There's going to be some individual variability there. But if you're someone that starts a yoga practice and you see that resting heart rate fall from like, you know, in the 60s to the mid 50s, that's fantastic. But it might take a little bit more, you know, deliberate effort to get it much lower than that. And everyone's experience is going to be different. It's going to depend on the exact yoga practice, exactly how much time you're doing. But you could take a look at something like that and kind of see where you're at. How much additional effort is it going to take to kind of reach your cardiovascular goals?
How long do you think it would take someone? And I get, obviously, it depends on so many factors, where they're starting, how often they're doing it. But like, what would be a reasonable time frame to expect like a a change that would exceed measurement error on your resting heart rate? Like, you know, how many weeks of yoga would you think it might take if you're doing it a few times a week, starting from somebody who is relatively sedentary, to see like a 5 beat per minute drop?
For sure. I mean, aerobic improvement is relatively slow as far as, you know, fitness adaptations go. It's not something that you're going to see overnight. I like to think of it sort of like your body weight. You know, you're going to see day-to-day fluctuations. You know, you might gain a pound, lose a pound, that kind of thing. And it's not something to worry about or get too worked up over. You know, with your aerobic fitness, your resting heart rate, that kind of thing, you could see a lot of ups and downs over the course of a few days, a week, et cetera. When I'm measuring someone's aerobic improvement, I really like to look for trends over 8 to 12 weeks. So if you start a yoga practice, monitor something like your resting heart rate, for example, and track that over, you know, 2-3 months. If you're not seeing a big improvement after 2 or 3 months, that's a good indicator that you're probably not getting the cardiovascular stimulus you think, or at least need to do a little bit more, you know, specific cardio if you do want to make some progress there.
And as far as measuring that, just some of the things that can affect it would be like time of day, like, so you would want to take it same time every day under the same conditions, like lying down or sitting. Like if you're sick, I know that can affect it. So like,
yeah, yeah, hydration is a big one too. Like, yeah.
Yeah. Just making sure like, oh, it's, you know, it's 5 beats per minute more today. Like I got so out of shape overnight. It's like, no, just, you know, you might be stressed or like something could be going on. So like you said, taking it over a longer duration.
Yeah. Especially I like to tell people if you have a, you know, ups and downs throughout your week and that kind of stuff, pick kind of the same time, same day, like every Sunday morning, for example, you do your little resting heart rate test. Or, you know, nowadays so many people have, you know, their Apple Watches, their Garmins or whatever, they have a lot more data, which can be helpful. But if you are, you know, tracking manually or something like that, or want to know when to look, I would, you know, pick kind of the same time, same day, and look at it week over week.
Yeah, that's a good point. Back in my day, like when I was swimming, this was 10 years ago, like I would throw my chest strap on every morning before I got out of bed. Yeah. And like get a good few minutes of relaxation to get a good accurate number. But now you don't have to do anything because the watch and, you know, wrist worn isn't going to be necessarily as accurate as a chest strap. But if it's the same, if you're using the same measurement over time, then it should give you, you know, it might not be the perfect number, but it'll tell you over time if it's changing.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And depending on what your, you know, preferred form of cardio is, you know, if you do like to run a little bit or bike, or if you, you know, row on a rowing erg, something like that, there's a lot of charts and stuff available online where you can put in, you know, your best mile time or your 2K row time and variety of things. And they'll tell you like if you're fit or not, you know, what your VO2 max estimate is, that kind of thing. And you can kind of see where you stand. And sometimes it can be disheartening to realize, you know, oh, I'm not quite as fit as I thought I was or whatever. But there are you know, benchmarks you might want to strive for if you're serious about your cardio goals.
I was administering the PACER test a little while ago to a few people and like they looked good to me. And then when I compared them to the norms, I was like, damn, you got to be really fast to like have a good VO2 predicted number from your PACER. PACER is like this beep test where you run back and forth and it gradually gets faster and faster to try to get you to your max or to get you to your max. And it's pretty miserable.
Yeah, I mean, your VO2 max is important as far as, you know, knowing exactly what yours is, you know, that you don't have to know from a training perspective. But VO2 max is kind of the single best predictor we have of overall cardiovascular disease risk, mortality risk. It's more impactful or predictive than socioeconomic status, smoking status, alcohol use, any of those things that seem really important and are, those don't predict overall, like, disease risk or mortality risk as much as just your aerobic fitness status. So it's super important to get into that upper category.
And even better than strength, would you say?
Even better than strength from a mortality perspective, yeah. So kind of your risk of, basically when I look at the mortality data, it's kind of look at someone's VO2 max and then look at whether they are still alive 10 years from now. So basically your risk of dying over the next 10 years your aerobic fitness status is the best way we have of predicting whether you're going to be alive 10 years from now.
Doesn't fit my bias or narrative for selling strength training, but
I know.
Obviously, oh, yeah. It's not a one or the other, right? I mean,
right.
you could speak right. to that too.
I was just going to say, like you said, it's not one or the other. You know, as far as a lot of underlying health metrics, like your fasting blood glucose, your blood pressure, that kind of thing, we can kind of look for a dose response relationship with like aerobic training and how that impacts some of those underlying factors, strength training and some of those factors. And we definitely see that all fitness is good fitness. Like there's no reason to not be fit in a particular category, but it's equally important not to ignore one. So if you're someone who is very cardiovascular proficient, you have a great aerobic system, that's great. You have a lot of things going for you, but that's not a reason to not be strong, right? Like all those other things matter too, and vice versa. So not to say that, you know, aerobic fitness is more important than any other type of fitness. I'm just kind of highlighting the importance of not neglecting it.
What benefits can strength training give us that are different, like speaking longevity wise and healthy aging? What benefits would strength have that are different from cardiovascular training?
For sure. I mean, strength training, gosh, I like to think of, you know, like your risk of falling, right? Like people are always saying, you know, like I'm training for my summer body or whatever. I'm like, I'm training not to break my hip on a flight of stairs when I'm 80 years old, you know? That's, to me, that's like the power of strength training right there. It's just not just your ability to be alive 10 years from now, but your ability to be doing cool stuff, you know? So strength training is great for that. Things like bone density, your overall amount of lean muscle tissue is really important for like your fasting blood glucose. So as far as like if you're someone who's diabetic or pre-diabetic, for example, strength training is super important for that, kind of from a management or prevention perspective. I'd say almost more than aerobic fitness. So again, one's not better than the other, but you know, when you look at kind of the full spectrum of health, there's going to be things that strength is great for, that aerobic fitness is great for, but there's a ton of overlap too, and you're going to be best off doing some of both.
You mentioned bone density a moment ago as a benefit of strength training, like improved bone density. And we certainly have like I think if you took like the average yoga practitioner, it would be a female in their, you know, middle age, maybe a little older. So for our specific audience, something like bone density is particularly relevant with, you know, osteoporosis and that type of condition. So I do wonder, at least I tend to see a lot of claims out there made that that like running or walking are really good for improving bone density. And I wonder what you think about that, like how, if and how those type of modalities could be quote good for bone density and how that compares to strength training. Maybe I'll throw out there that there's also a lot in the yoga world, you also often hear that yoga is really good for bone density too.
Yeah, for sure. So improvements to bone density basically follow what's called Wolf's Law, which basically means you take a bone, you know, you deform a bone enough, put a bone under enough stress and strain that it's forced to adapt. That means that the activity has to be sufficiently demanding in terms of, you know, impact or load to cause significant bone deformation. So basically, if you wanted to break a bone, do that thing just not as hard. you know, find the amount of stress that you can tolerate, you can adapt to, but isn't going to injure you, right? So generally when people are too gentle with these sorts of things, you know, they're doing, you know, water aerobics and Pilates, for example. I love these things. I love these things. But when you're very, very gentle and you do things that are totally non-impact, very gentle, very, you know, safe, quote unquote, those things, your acute risk of injury, like I've really never heard of anybody getting hurt doing water aerobics, right? But you're also not getting that stress to adapt and be prepared for an even larger stress in the future. So you want the impact, you want the load, you want the things that might, you know, scare you just a little bit, and just adjust the dose, make it tolerable, allow yourself to progress over time. But we need to keep, you know, stimuli like that in your program. And I think that's a big mistake people make, you know, as they age, as they start to prioritize some of these more gentle forms of exercise, which is fantastic. But we want to keep the stimulus there to keep you fit and be prepared for those things. The second we start avoiding it, you know, avoidance is the beginning of weakness as far as that kind of stuff goes. Bone density specifically, it is specific to the bones being stressed. So when you're walking or running, you know, you're getting lower body impact. You're going to be building up bone density and strength and resilience in the lower limbs, the knees, the hips, et cetera. But that doesn't necessarily mean that you're improving your bone density in your hands and wrists, for example. So when it comes to like a strength training program, a full body strength training program, that's your best opportunity for improving bone density, not just in your ankles or your knees, but your whole body, everything that's under load. So again, it's one of those things, do it all. You know, there's no fitness is bad fitness. But yoga itself, you know, is fairly gentle. Certainly is going to be better than no exercise, but I wouldn't put it up there with one of the top forms of exercise as far as bone density is concerned.
Better than water aerobics because you're weight bearing. Yes. But if you're looking at the, like you said, it's a continuum and something's better than nothing, but the more load that you can be under, the better, basically, as long as it's just
exactly
slightly a little more than you've done before and it's gradual.
Exactly.
And another aspect that I had learned about before with regard to bone density is that bone cells, they get bored easily, like quickly. With something like walking or running, they can maybe offer some stimulus, but because those tend to be longer forms of movement at some point, and from what I learned, it's not very far into like a session of walking or running, the bone cells just kind of stop listening, and the adaptation for bone density improvement you just don't get very much beyond a certain amount. And so that's why my understanding was like strength training was maybe a more potent stimulus, or things like plyometrics, jump training, because they're quicker bursts, but maybe even offer more stimulus that the bone cells sense.
Yeah, I've heard that too. I've heard that whole like they stop listening after a couple of minutes and that kind of thing.
Is that not true?
I don't think that it's not true. But I think we need a lot more data to kind of understand how different sorts of activities and different durations are going to impact bone density long term. I think it might be oversimplified rather than not true. I think the practical takeaway from that is don't just rely on like one 20-mile run over the weekend and boom, I got all my bone density, you know, for the week kind of thing.
right.
You know, you want to apply, you know, continuous kind of stress throughout the week, throughout your life. It's not something you can get from just, you know, one tough workout, for example. It's get out there every day, like load the body, do something, stay active all the time. There is probably a threshold past which you're not going to get additional benefit. You know, a 30-mile run is probably not better than a 20-mile run, that kind of thing. You know, more is not always better. But staying as active as you can, you know, on a very regular basis is going to be your best bet.
Yeah. And with it sounds like a nice variety of types of inputs, not necessarily just like mono training, just the same thing.
Yeah.
To like maximize. Sure. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Well, you mentioned, this was a question we had wanted to ask you that I think is sort of related, but you mentioned, for example, we were talking about bone density and you were like, a 30-mile run may not be better than a 20-mile run. But maybe if we shift it to more cardiovascular adaptations, we had actually gotten quite a few questions from people for you, which was just, and this is more from kind of that general health perspective, like, is there an optimal amount of cardio dosage? People were curious, like, how much time in one session, you know, how many per week, that kind of thing. Like what's kind of optimal, and that beyond that is maybe diminishing returns.
Yeah, for sure. And the majority of the research that we have in terms of the effects on like the cellular level, so like mitochondrial volume and density, those cellular adaptations to cardio and cardiac output, VO2 max, the single most important thing is just getting it done one way or the other. So whether that's, you know, 3 1-hour sessions or 2 90-minute sessions, or, you know, however you want to allocate your time throughout the course of a week, you know, however you get in your cardiovascular volume over every, you know, 7 to 10 day period, give or take, just getting the work done at some point is by far the most important thing. That being said, a lot of times the limiting factor for accruing cardiovascular volume is like local tissue tolerance. So you try to put in all of your running for the week in one long run, you might run into issues with, you know, your feet or your knees or whatever, versus if you spread that volume out, you know, locally and muscularly, you're going to be able to tolerate that volume a lot better. So in theory, it doesn't matter so much as long as you're getting the work done, you know, over the course of the week. Practically, spacing that out over a couple of sessions, is just going to feel a lot more manageable fatigue-wise and that kind of thing. And it can also really help with the habit formation. I remember I was reading one study, it's a long time ago now, so I could be misquoting it a little bit, but they were looking at how satisfied people were and how much they, quote, enjoyed their cardio fitness program. And they found that people who hit the 3-time-a-week training frequency, they reported enjoying it much more than people who trained less than that. Because it just helped them get into that rhythm. They had that habit of like, all right, it's time to run or time to do whatever. Versus, you know, if you're only doing once a week, you're like, oh man, it's time to, I got to do my run again. So just that habit part can be really helpful too. So I always tell people, for most people, unless you're training for, you know, a marathon or performance or something like that, if you're just in it for the health of it, just figure out how much time you want to commit per week and just get it done one way or the other. You know, your personal logistics, your personal preference, that is by far going to be the most important thing. Now, as far as total time goes, the CDC recommendation is 75 to 150 minutes a week of what they call vigorous intensity cardio. Open to interpretation a little bit, but by vigorous just means gets you sweating, gets you breathing a little bit harder. You know, that's what I would consider your, you know, zone 2 cardio, I think, would fall in that vigorous category of exercise. So 75 minutes to 150 minutes a week on the low end of that guideline, that could be, you know, 3 25-minute sessions. On the upper end of that guideline, that'd be like 3 50-minute sessions, or again, break that apart in different ways to fit your liking. Stuff like yoga, I think for someone that's just trying to meet physical activity guidelines, you're probably going to be able to, you know, count that towards some of that guideline. But again, see how you feel, see how you respond, and be open to adding more depending on how you feel and, you know, some of those health metrics.
That makes so much sense. And that's encouraging, I think, for our yoga audience to consider that yoga potentially, and we know there are a variety of styles of yoga, but maybe a more active flowing practice or something could be potentially considered to fall into that category of like the recommendations by the CDC. But also a good point that, you know, once someone adapts to those loads and maybe their resting heart rate has dropped down on that chronic level to it's plateaued, then maybe they need to step it up a little bit. And that's, you know, maybe that's a good problem to have because it just means that you're getting healthier, but just maybe need to broaden the movement box a little bit.
And everyone's experience will be different. You know, you could, there's what we call, you know, non-responders versus high responders and everything in between in terms of how people adapt to a given training program. And some people out there are very lucky in that they do a little bit of cardio and they are super fit, right? And that's going to be your person who, like, all they do is yoga, and like the first time they run, they like run a sub 20-minute 5K, and you're like, how do you do that? That's not fair.
I had that experience a couple years ago with Jenny. So I had been running a lot. I got a running prosthesis. And like, Jenny, I don't know when the last time you had run before this, but I was like, I want to time a mile while I'm visiting North Carolina because they had a track in their neighborhood.
That's where I live. It's North Carolina.
Yeah. So I brought my running leg. I had been training for it. Like, I was going to time trial this mile. And I don't know when the last time you did a mile was, Jenny, but like you did it with ease. Maybe, you know, you said that it was not super easy. And our I'm an amputee, like our time was 11 minutes or something. So it wasn't like this, we weren't breaking any world records here. But I was just amazed that, like, because if you don't do any running, like when I started running, I couldn't do a mile straight. But Jenny, like, strength trains and does yoga many days of the week for many years. And like, you were very well prepared to run a mile straight. You also walk dogs fairly vigorously, a couple miles a day. So like, there's that part of the preparation. But yeah, so some people, and not to say that you're like a super high responder or whatever, but I was amazed that, like, you know, having not done any running for I don't know how long, you were just able to run a mile and you were just fine.
And so there's so many interesting points to discuss there with, like, one, the habits that you don't see, right? Like, you see someone who, like, from your perspective, they're just a yogi, and then you like see that they, you know, they post on Instagram or whatever, they ran some 5K, and you're like, well, how, that's not fair. Like, all they do is yoga. And it's like, well, you don't see them walking dogs all the time. You don't see them at the gym doing this or that. Like, we make a lot of assumptions about people. And I think that can be misleading. You know, in the fitness space, we have this idea of how someone trains and we see the results, but there's a lot of things we don't see as well. So kind of falls into that category we talked about at the beginning of the show of these, you know, unseen assumptions, you know, with how people adapt and the results that they get. A lot of times you just don't see the work, you don't see the lifestyle factors, and you assume too much about like what any given thing is doing for them. But at the same time, again, you do have these kind of high responders and non-responders. So then everyone, you know, they get into a conversation, you know, like a family reunion, and they're like, well, my friend's cousin, whatever, you know, all they do is, you know, they're a yogi and they eat the carnivore diet and they're super jacked or something. And it's like, you know, there's all these super specific examples, right? But we have to fall back on like, not what worked for that, like, you know, friend's cousin, but like what works for the overall population, right? And not get caught up in too many of these, like, you know, niche cases. And I think cardio is a great example of that, because everyone likes to talk about that one person they know that like has a very like minimal approach to their training, or like only does this or that and is still in good cardiovascular shape. Well, that's great for them that works for them, but that's just not how cardio works for most people, you know? And I think that's important to keep in mind.
Absolutely. And is a good message to put out there and just, yeah, educate people so we understand, like, in a bigger picture and for the majority of the population, what works and what doesn't. Now, there is another topic that we were hoping to ask you about, Alec, which is really related to everything we've talked about so far. But I thought of it because you were telling us about kind of the long-term benefits of, say, cardiovascular exercise versus strength training, how there's a ton of overlap, of course, but there are some distinctions. But with regard to just thinking about cardio and strength training in general, we know that you're very familiar with, there are a lot of ideas out there that, you know, if say strength training is your priority and what you want to focus on, sometimes we hear that if you bring cardio into your movement repertoire, that'll work against your strength trains. And I think that's something called the interference effect, I think. Mm-hmm. So we wanted to ask you about, are those claims true? What is up with the interference effect in doing both cardio and strength, like, concurrently?
Yeah, for sure. So there's definitely this thing we call the interference effect, which is two different types of training can potentially interfere. But people often get so caught up on the ways that different types of training can interfere that they forget there's also a synergistic effect. And there's ways that different types of energy systems and aspects of fitness actually support each other. And depending on where you are kind of on the spectrum from beginner to intermediate, advanced, how good you are, sometimes the synergistic effect is far more important. And then the better and better you get, the more this idea of interference might become relevant. But we see all the time and time again, in different kind of fitness studies that when someone is a beginner, all fitness overlaps tremendously. So when you take someone who's never exercised before, whether you have them do strength training or have them do running or whatever, they adapt positively in all the sorts of ways you can imagine. You know, someone that has never exercised before, they start a running program, they build some muscle, they lose some fat, their aerobic system increases, like all these positive fitness adaptations. And you see that almost regardless of what they do or what the program is. On the other hand, you take someone who's, you know, an elite athlete or, you know, a world record holder in a specific sport, if you have them deviate from that super specific plan in any direction, their performance is going to suffer. The average person, and I'd say the vast majority of even fairly athletic individuals, despite, thinking that they're closer to that latter side. They everyone likes to think of themselves as the elite athlete. Most people, as far as how they actually respond to training, are much closer to the beginner than I think they'd care to admit. And that's not a bad thing. It's not a dig at anybody, but for most people are just not good enough at what they do for that interference effect to be extremely significant. Most people still have a lot of that kind of synergistic effect on the table. So for example, a lot of people who they prioritize strength in the gym, they're still at a point where if they got their aerobic capacity up a little bit, they would probably see improved recovery kind of day to day between sets. They might improve their overall work capacity and actually be able to get more out of their strength training sessions. Is that true for, you know, Mr. Olympia, professional bodybuilder? No, certainly not. But where most people are, and a lot of the people that get kind of concerned about this interference effect, I think it's the last thing that they should be worrying about. You know, focus on being a nice, well-rounded human first. You know, me, I'm a big advocate for the CDC physical activity guidelines. 75 to 150 minutes of physical activity, physical cardiovascular activity per week, and at least twice a week full body strength training. I believe everybody should be meeting those kind of minimum expectations, regardless of what your specific goals are. And I think for 99.9% of the population, if you're not meeting those, that should be your first priority, and that's going to help you accomplish everything else that you might have in mind.
That is a really reassuring answer, and I think can help maybe put some people's minds at ease. I know it's easy to just kind of get caught up in like these questions that maybe make us like overanalyze details when maybe it's like those questions may not even necessarily apply to us and we just don't need to worry.
Yeah. Well, and especially with the interference effect, like any added stress of the system is not going to feel great in the short term. You know, so if you're strength training, for example, and you decide I'm going to add some cardio, that might kind of suck for a little bit until you kind of get used to it. But so would starting a new job. So would, you know, staying up late the night before, like any sort of added stress is going to be like, oh, that's, you know, made my workout a little bit harder today. But in the case of cardio, unlike some of those other cases I mentioned, you do adapt positively to it. So like you adapt to the stress, get used to the stress, and what felt like it kind of hurt your workout a couple weeks ago, now you're just kind of rolling with it, no big deal, and now you're fitter because of it. So I think a lot of times that interference effect that people experience is sometimes a case of just be patient with it. It's not going to feel great at first. Just like adding in more strength training volume or adding more yoga volume is not going to feel great at first. You got to give it the time, give yourself the opportunity to adapt.
Yeah. So if you see those really short term, like performance decrements and you're like, oh, look at that's the interference effect. I mean, it's not really the interference effect. That's just adding more. Exactly. And if you can get over that, then your performance will return back to where it was. And then maybe you even have more of a foundation to exceed that. But we're talking about several weeks or months, maybe.
Yeah.
That is a really great answer as far as just kind of like the bigger picture and like acute versus chronic effects, which makes me remember something else we wanted to ask you about the relationship between strength training and cardio training is you're suggesting that for the vast majority of people, they don't need to worry about the interference effect. But what about strength training and cardio training, say, like on the same day or within the same like workout? So that's a very common question too. And we got that question for you as well. Like if you want to do both, you know, at the same time or really in close proximity, which one should you do first? Does it matter? What's up with that?
Yeah, for sure. I think more people are probably familiar with like when you do a strength training session, there's kind of a natural order that just kind of makes sense. There's some science to back it up, but I think most people know when you walk in a gym, if you have like, if you're going to do back squats, for example, and then you have like leg extensions in your program too, you're probably going to do like your heavy stuff first. You're probably going to start off with some of the squats, the main movements, et cetera, and then follow that up with like your lighter, you know, secondary movements, accessories, isolation movements, whatever you want to call them. There's kind of this move from your highest intensity, kind of highest output, most demanding work, followed by, you know, some of the more isolated, you know, lower intensity or lower output movement. And I think we can follow that kind of same guideline when it comes to building a concurrent program of doing the most demanding you know, thing that's going to take you the most energy, that should probably come first when you're the most fresh. When it comes to most cardio, especially like your low to moderate intensity cardio, even though it might be tiring, you know, in terms of like total energy expenditure compared to the intensity of like a squat, you know, a heavy squat where you got to get under the bar, get psyched up, brace yourself, et cetera, you know, going for a steady run is a much lower kind of level of output. So following that same kind of pattern that you would for just designing a strength workout, for example, same thing. It's like that strength work, you got to, you know, focus on, you know, quality over quantity, put everything you got into each rep, each set, et cetera. If you end up a little bit tired, say by the time you get to the run and you have to slow down just a hair, your stimulus, your benefit from that is not going to change drastically. Whereas if you do like a long run first and head into the gym and you're tired, if your output suffers, you know, more than a couple percent on like a squat, for example, you might, you know, cease to get as much out of that as you would really like. So overall, I tell people start with that higher intensity, higher output work, which would be like your strength training, follow it up with the cardio. That's my kind of default. Same thing in the case of yoga, for example, like if you're trying to do strength and yoga, I wouldn't recommend trying to do like a heavy squat immediately after a yoga class when you're already fatigued and tired. But you could probably, you know, still go for a 20 or 30 minute jog afterwards and it wouldn't be as big of a deal. So I generally follow that kind of descending intensity principle. Occasionally there's some, you know, exceptions to that. I'd say when we look at kind of your level as an athlete, are you beginner, intermediate, advanced? Knowing that beginners, they have some of those newbie gains on the table. They can adapt and improve very, very easily. Whereas the advanced athlete, you know, they really got to be on top of their game any given day to reach the level of stimulus and output they need. In that case, sometimes I'll recommend if you're like really advanced at one discipline, but a ranked beginner at the other, is do that thing you're advanced at first when you can dedicate, you know, the time, energy, attention that it really needs. And then do that thing you're a beginner at afterwards where, yeah, you might be a little bit tired, but you don't need to be at your best to still learn and grow and adapt. So a couple things to consider there, but general rule of thumb is that kind of descending intensity principle.
It always, like, the way I think of it is from a safety standpoint, like if you tire yourself out doing 30 minutes of running and then you go do back squats, like you're just, the risk is just a little bit higher. But the two things that I theoretically, I don't work with that many people who are trying to combine both, but like if someone asks me, I sort of say like, well, what are you trying? What's your number one priority? If it is marathon training, and this kind of ties in with like what season you're in, like, are you in marathon prep? Like if you're 4 months away and you're like heavy into marathon prep, maybe that's too long, 3 months away, let's say, like, yeah, maybe you do your running first and then you fit your strength training in after, just because like the training should be super specific. Or if you're just like running is the number one important thing for you, then do the running first. But outside of that, like in your off season, or if you're trying to prioritize strength right now, then do the thing that's most important to you first. But that, yeah, that kind of, you know, there are a lot of ways to think about it, and that they may or may not always be the same as some of the considerations that you mentioned.
Yeah, I think a huge thing to discuss here that applies, you know, outside of even this discussion is just the idea of optimal versus practical. And as far as like session order and that kind of stuff, we could talk kind of the like, you know, energy systems, pros and cons, and, you know, enzymatic pathways. You know, we could talk about that until we're blue in the face in terms of what's optimal. But then you end up, you know, coaching someone, writing a program for someone, and they start telling you like they got to drop their kids off at school, their home gym is here, the park they run at is here. And it's like, well, you know, what's optimal doesn't really matter. Doesn't really matter anymore.
Yeah. Goes back to getting work it in, like you said.
Yeah. So I think a lot of people, you know, especially in the non like competitive athlete space, you know, people who are, they're just trying to meet those activity guidelines that they want to be, you know, pretty fit in a wide variety of areas, but they're not trying to, you know, train for a CrossFit competition or a marathon or anything like that. It very much becomes a case of practical, you know, supersedes optimal. So just kind of get it in. What allows you to have the most fun, spend the least amount of time and energy on your fitness so you still have a life afterwards. That kind of stuff is super important. I always hate to see like people who are just starting out get so caught up in optimizing their program that it takes the fun out of it. Because to me, that's not sustainable. Like training should be fun, you know? So optimize where you can, but realize that, you know, some imperfections here and there are fine, and having fun and having a sustainable program, one that's efficient in terms of your time and energy, is extremely important too.
That is such a great perspective to share. Thank you for that, Alec. And I really appreciate how your response about like, which should we do first, strength or cardio, was just really like nuanced, you know, and diplomatic. Like, I feel like you kind of gave us what the evidence suggests, but also there can be these exceptions. And so it's just, you know, there's options there, but it definitely makes sense what you outlined as far as like that intensity and the descending order. And I think Travis and I maybe just have like one, maybe two more questions for you. But one that we wanted to ask you about that we haven't gotten to yet is cardio with regard to recovery. So we got some questions about this. Like people were just wondering, you know, say, because like we said, a lot of our audience tends to be more strength, but like strength and yoga is kind of their thing. So they're wondering, like after a strength session, is it a good idea to do, like, should I do cardio, like low, you know, low intensity, sustained, or whatever that's called, cardio.
Yeah.
So is that a good idea? Is it important? What's up with cardio for recovery?
Yeah. Yes and no. So this is definitely, it's a question I'm somewhat passionate about and think is really, really interesting. So first we'll say that the aerobic system is also kind of the recovery system. So even if you're doing high intensity exercise, you know, where you're depleting your creatine phosphate reserves or your muscle glycogen, the recovery of basically recovery of all muscle energetics is an aerobic process. So in fact, it's so dependent on your aerobic fitness that we can look and we can measure the recovery of creatine phosphate into the muscle, and that we can calculate what someone's VO2 max is from that. So recovery of muscle energetics is extremely aerobic, extremely dependent on like what your VO2 max is and that kind of thing. So yes, your cardiovascular fitness, your aerobic capacity, the oxidative capacity of your muscles is ultimately what drives recovery. That being said, it doesn't mean that we can just like do more cardio to recover faster necessarily, because doing cardiovascular training is also an additional training stress that needs to be recovered from. You know, so we want to have the fitness there to support recovery, but we also want to have the time to actually rest and recover and that kind of thing too. As far as like what people call active recovery sessions, so, you know, getting on a spin bike or going for a walk and that kind of thing, you know, how does that play into recovery? Does it speed recovery? Does it not speed recovery? It's one of those things that people like, it's one of the things I get hate mail about of when I say
people
like,
swear by it.
Yeah, people swear by it. People feel very passionately about active recovery. But in the context of someone that their aerobic system is already well developed. So if you're someone that is aerobically fit, there's very little evidence to suggest that adding an additional like very low intensity aerobic active recovery session is going to make much of a difference in your next performance. If you like it, do it. Like, it's certainly not going to hurt. But the evidence is pretty weak and pretty mixed in terms of, you know, if you do or don't do that like 10 to 15 minute light bike ride post workout, like what is that going to do for your performance the next day? And it's like kind of a toss up. It doesn't seem to really matter all that much. Being aerobically fit, having some aerobic capacity, definitely super important. That's the big one. Get some rest, you know, de-stress, all that kind of stuff. That's also super important. But the exact specifics of like, do you just go home and play some video games? Do you go for an extra 10-minute walk? Do you foam roll? Like, it probably doesn't matter all that much in the context of a good program, of course. That being said, if you're someone who otherwise doesn't do cardio at all, like that light active recovery session, that might be the cardio that you need to be doing in the week. You know, so there is some case where, yeah, you should hop on the bike because you're not doing cardio otherwise. And then there's the one caveat that people will always kind of say, well, what about this? Is some low intensity cardio after like a really high intensity session. It can help you just kind of de-stress, return to like a resting and, you know, relaxing state more quickly. Is that super significant? You know, if you get into, you know, that kind of anabolic state or resting and recovery state again, you know, an extra 30 minutes to an hour faster, you know, over the course of like a 72 hour process, you know, which recovery is, it's kind of a drop in the bucket as far as I'm concerned. You know, you're able to start resting, you know, an additional hour sooner. Technically optimal, but practically it's probably such a small difference. It's not going to make or break the program again. So yeah, as far as active recovery goes, do what your heart tells you, do it if you want, but it's not something you should feel like you have to force yourself to do.
I was so shocked because I looked into like just general recovery strategies like a year or two ago. And like, as an athlete, I was brought up like, you got to cool down after, you know, swim practice for a few hundred yards. Like we would do these, like if we came back from a training trip where it was like 7 or 10 days of hard training, 2 days, like the day we came back, we would have a swim out where we would just like loosen up, but not do anything hard. And like, yeah, the intention was, oh, this is active recovery. And then I look into the research and it's like, there's nothing like sleep, nutrition. like those are one and two, you know, maybe hydration, just resting and relaxation. Like those are so much, the evidence and the effect of those things are so much better than doing these recovery things. But like you said, if you swear by it and you like to do it, then like, don't stop.
Yeah.
But
I mean, as far as the recovery goes, like recovery is very much a multifaceted process. You know, you have to recover, you know, energy, glycogen, whatever, rehydrate, repair muscle damage. There's all sorts of like kind of subcomponents to recovery, you know, alleviate muscle soreness, whatever. And oftentimes people think that feeling better equals recovery. But feeling better is just, it's one small factor of recovery, you know. In some cases, it might be significant. And one example, someone had actually asked me in regards to a recent post on this very topic on active recovery. They were talking about the Tour de France and like recovery rides or kind of post-race recovery when they're in the middle of like a multi-week competition. Like that's totally different than like a regular training program where you need to be ready to push hard again in 2 or 3 days. When you have to turn around and race like every day in a row for like 3 straight weeks, you might, you know, that little component of recovery of feeling a little bit better, feeling a little bit less stiff the next day starts to matter a whole lot more in that context. But just because it makes sense for like a Tour de France rider to do a little recovery ride so they're slightly less stiff the next day, probably not super meaningful or impactful for like, you know, you strength training 2-3 times a week or whatever. So you just have to be careful about like applying those, you know, practices from professional competition to like, does it actually matter for someone just trying to be fit?
Yeah. Like, oh, recovery, like that sounds like it's all the same thing, but it's like, well, recovery for when and recovery for like, how are you measuring it? Your perception,
right?
Or more objective measures. Like I think in that post you were talking about, well, nobody ever or rarely actually measures performance. They measure these surrogate measures, and that may or may not be a one-to-one relationship with like, how do you perform the next day? And then does that matter for that matters for Lance Armstrong? Does it matter for Joe Schmo?
Yeah. Well, and even with like feeling better, sometimes it can be a bad thing. So like if you trick someone into feeling better, give someone a ton of painkillers, for example, and then they go back out there a day sooner, like that's probably not a good idea. So
on
feeling
many,
better,
many levels, yeah.
yeah, feeling better in the context of recovery could very well be a bad thing. And we see that with like, you know, excessive use of anti-inflammatory drugs, ice baths, that kind of thing. You know, the dose makes the poison, right? But like feeling better for recovery doesn't always mean better recovery.
Yeah. Well, and the ice baths thing is an interesting one because that's all the rage these days. And yes, it might help you recover faster in the short term. And then it also blunts adaptations to training.
Right.
So if you're doing it all the time, then you're actually getting less out of the work that you're doing.
Yeah. Very few shortcuts as far as adaptation is concerned, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
That makes so much sense. Thank you for that excellent answer about active recovery. And I again feel like that's kind of reassuring because maybe it just like opens the door to there could be multiple options for recovery, including just doing nothing. And maybe just like the one
Passive recovery.
Yeah,
makes passive it sound, recovery. Makes it sound like you're doing something more. Alec, you said playing video games. Passive recovery.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, obviously, there are other examples, like, you know, receiving a massage, I guess, would be an example.
Gentle yoga, restorative yoga.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, as far as, like, recovery goes, like, it's actual actionable tips, because I feel like it can be, you know, it's kind of popular now to say, like, you know, just rest, like, just take the time, like, none of these things, like, foam rolling, whatever, it's all a sham. I feel like a lot of people say that nowadays, which I'm happy to at least see the narrative move in that direction. But it doesn't mean that there's nothing you can do. And I think that's important to note. When we think about recovery as like the combination of all these like different kind of sub processes of feeling better, reducing soreness, fixing muscle damage, or recovering energy, all that kind of stuff, there's a few kind of overlapping or overarching themes and kind of inputs that we need to recover. We need kind of the nutrients, right? Like we need protein availability, we need energy availability. So that's super important as far as just like nutrition and diet goes. Hydration, all that kind of stuff is very important. You need time and rest and kind of a low stress environment that's conducive to healing and recovery. And that is something that you have control over. So a lot of the kind of recovery modalities that don't, you know, work, so to speak, anything that can lower your stress or that you enjoy can be of some benefit. So, you know, should you stress about the fact that you're spending $100 on a massage that it hurts and you hate it? Like, that's probably not a good idea. But if you're like, I love massage and I don't care that it costs money or whatever, like if you enjoy doing that, knock yourself out. That's fantastic. Like if it feels good, if you like it and it's not like an additional stress, then that's definitely a good thing. So we're definitely going to see some like variability in terms of how people respond to different things for that reason too. You know, cause some people don't like massages, some people do, and et cetera. And ultimately, whatever gets your stress level down and helps you get into that resting and reparative state, that's super important. As far as that stuff goes, things like, honestly, having a life and doing things outside of your sport and your training. So like, go hang out with friends, play video games, like do something that's fun and different. And is completely removed from your training, that's ultimately one of the very best things that you can do to recover, which sounds a bit counterintuitive, but like get out, do something else, you know, forget about your sport or your practice for a little bit. That's going to get you ready to get back to it as soon as you can.
Wow. I love that. That's such a really diplomatic take and a great message, I think, to reinforce, because certain types of people, I think, can get very, very caught up and attached to their training or even their yoga practice. Like that can become all consuming. So it's a great reminder that balance can also be very helpful and aid something like recovery. Travis, I don't know about you, but I kind of feel like Alec may have answered just about all the questions that we had for him today.
Yeah, I guess the last thing that I would ask, like somebody who's doing yoga a lot, somebody who maybe has already taken on a strength training practice, but just hasn't done cardio lately or ever, like where do they start? And I, you know, we've alluded to this before, like maybe try to work towards those CDC guidelines, do something that you enjoy. You can space it out however you want, but are there other kinds of recommendations or modal, like just tips that you've found that work for those sorts of people?
My first tip is any cardio is more cardio than you're currently doing. So like the best place to start is just by doing something, something accessible, something you can do consistently and kind of build upon. That's going to be your best place to start. But as far as like overall kind of fitness goes, I always like to look for kind of gaps in a program. So like what's something that's very different or the most different from kind of the existing stimuli in your program? Not only is that probably going to have the best kind of bang for your buck in terms of adaptation, but you're probably going to notice it the least in terms of like overall recovery demands, because it's not redundant. You're not like overloading something you're already doing a lot of. So when we think of like strength training, I think of that as like kind of the upper bounds of like intensity. And when I think of yoga, I think of something much, you know, it can still be hard, right? But it's continuous. It's fairly gentle. It's as far as cardio goes, you might get a mild cardiovascular stimulus from it. So if you already kind of have those two things going for you, I see good opportunity kind of somewhere in the middle for like either a moderate output sustained cardio, like go for a moderate to hard 20 to 30 minute run, or bike ride or whatever your chosen modality is, but something kind of in the middle there, once, twice a week, pick a time, duration that works for you. That I think is going to be very different and kind of a novel stimulus compared to what you're already experiencing. Kind of a short burst of high intensity in the gym, the kind of steady flow of a yoga practice. Get out there and try to sit in an uncomfortably, hard intensity for, 20 minutes, half an hour, something like that. I think that would complement your existing program really well. But again, so many different things will work for different people. And the most important thing is consistency and being able to build upon it. So start small, start gentle, and kind of work your way up from there.
If 20 to 30 minutes sounded like too much, would 10 minutes twice a week be better than nothing, or 10 minutes a few more times than that, trying to accumulate the same amount? Is there a minimum effective dose, if that's the word?
Yeah, for sure. So this is a question I get a lot of, what's the minimum amount of time you need to do cardio to get benefit from it? And is there a maximum, past a certain point, is there a point of diminishing returns and that kind of thing? And if I was going to kind of draw it on a graph from too short to too long to ideal, that kind of thing, I think just leaving it as too short and too long is actually sufficient, because it's all relative to what's normal for that person. So if you're someone who's accustomed to doing a couple hours of cardio per week, the idea of a 10-minute cardio session probably sounds too short to you, and it probably is for that person. If you're someone who doesn't have any cardio experience at all, and you're I might only be able to fit in 10 minutes, that's probably not too short for you, because you're not currently doing a whole lot. So I think, when you think of, is it too much or not enough or whatever, how does it feel and what does it sound like to you, and kind of listen to that. Because if you're a beginner at cardio, a 10-minute session might be enough to get a good stimulus from. If you're an advanced, athlete, going for a 10-minute workout might not get you to a point where you start adapting a whole lot. But again, it's all relative to where you're at. So if it sounds short to you, it probably is. If it sounds like too much to you, it probably is. Do an amount that feels enough for you.
That's such a great, quick and easy rule to go by. I like how simple that is. And I think we can all just resonate and intuitively know what that means for us as a specific individual.
I'm inspired to get out there. I'm going to go for a swim tonight.
I love it, Travis. Alec, you've shared so much wonderful information with us, and just so thoroughly. And I feel like you packed so much information in to not even very long of a time. We're super thankful. Where can our listeners learn more from you and even potentially work with you? What's the best way to find you? We'll put links to all of these sources in the show notes, but if you just want to mention them now.
Yeah, for sure. The best place to find me, to get in contact with me, and I have all of my links and stuff too for a variety of programs and that kind of thing, is all on my Instagram. So find me at Alec Blenis. That's just my full name. Check out my posts there. I have some links there too for different programs and offerings and that kind of thing. And also keep an eye on my stories. I do a weekly question and answer. So questions like these, if you have more, I try to get to 10 to 20 questions per week. I don't get to all of them, of course, but I try to pick some good ones every week. So keep an eye on that. And I look forward to hearing from you.
That's so cool. And you said it's on Instagram, you're at your name, but just in case anyone's listening, it's A-L-E-C-B-L-E-N-I-S, right? That's how to spell your name.
That's it. Yeah.
And when you said, look at your stories, just so people know, we're talking Instagram stories, right? That's on Instagram.
Yes.
Just in case. Yeah. Some people don't know. So that is awesome. Well, we are so thankful to have had your time and your insights for both Travis and myself, and also for our whole audience. And I'm really excited for maybe new people to learn about you and what you have to offer who may not have known about you before.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It was a great opportunity to get in touch with some yogis and then hopefully help inspire some more people to do some cardio.
Thanks, Alec.
And that wraps up our look at what yogis should know about cardio. Remember that you could support our work with this podcast by subscribing to our podcast and leaving us a rating or a review. You can also stay in the loop with all of our offerings by signing up for my email newsletter at jennyrawlings.com/newsletter. Lastly, remember to use code PODCAST30 for 30% off your first month in Travis's and my Strength for Yoga remote group training program, or 30% off your first month in any of the other memberships on my website. You can learn more and sign up at jennyrawlings.com, and the link is in the show notes. Thanks again for listening to this episode of Yoga Meets Movement Science today. We look forward to seeing you in our next episode soon.